most out of the time that we do have with Stephen. It's my pleasure to introduce Stephen to you this afternoon, if you want to find more about him, then visit his website. I'm not going to introduce him to the individual. I'm a shameful borrower of ideas. I get them where I can and I use them where I can. And about 3 months ago, I had to present a paper on quality assurance and e-learning down in Jamaica. And I mentioned to Carolyn that I had to do this, and she said, you should go to Stephen's site and see if you can find anything there. And I did. And I shamefully borrowed it. I must tell you that what I borrowed is that his work is full of wonderful analogies which you can take and use. And the analogy that I stole from him was the analogy of the road versus a railway. And that both a road and a railway have to have the same function, which is to deliver people and goods. But the fact that a railway is so tied into its system that it's inflexible drives what can actually be carried on that, whereas roads have multiple uses. And of course the analogy that I was making was that as you build quality assurance into any sort of program evaluation, you have to make sure that you're building a road and not a railway, because the other thing about railways is the least little mistake throws the whole system out, whereas in roads it's different. His work is full of those. I recommend them to you. Stephen is an innovator, and the important thing about innovation is not only the innovator but what you do with the innovations. And sessions like this are important to us because we can get some of those ideas of innovations, and you take away is important because what you take away will not be what Stephen's he's giving you, it'll be what you've made of what he's giving you. And that's why these sessions are important. So Stephen, I'm looking forward to the presentation, and I'll let you go to it.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here in Halifax. A nice warm summer day. This is my website, downes.ca, D-O-W-N-E-S. Don't forget the E. I'm not sure where you go if you forget the E, and I don't want to find out.
You don't want to be responsible.
I won't be responsible. I'm not known for having particularly attractive PowerPoint slides. My imagination usually runs shy when it comes to putting together slideshows, but I do find it nice to have something on the screen. It's interesting. I never know how I'm going to start a talk because they all start differently. They all end up in the same place, which is a good thing, but they all start differently. Of course, I wasn't expecting a discussion of analogies, but I like analogies. Analogies are important to me. Analogies are what connects obscure, abstruse thought to common everyday reality, and I would be lost without them. I try to make them vivid, and thinking about analogies and roads and railways and things like that, it occurred to me as he was speaking, because you sometimes want to pick, right? And sometimes you're tempted to go with the railway because, you can make the trains run on time and all of that. But for the individual, and I'm very much an individual in all of this because I don't have a big corporation or university behind me. For an individual, the way to think of this analogy is if you're tempted to go with the railway, think about what happens if you try to ride your bicycle on it. Okay, that one fell flat. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's okay, I've learned to live with that. I've had to learn to live with it. The topic today is blogging and learning. I hope that's what you were promised. I don't have a whole lot of time. I guess I'm supposed to be out of here by 1. I'd like to leave a little bit of time for comments and questions. If you do have comments or questions during the course of the talk, please feel free. I like things that are interactive. I like it if I'm not talking about what you're interested in, for you to correct me. That's why I'm here, rather than sending you a videotape. If it was just me chatting, we can do that online. So if you want to challenge, question, expand, anything, anywhere along
the lines of this talk, by all means. If you'd like to steer it in a particular direction, please feel free to do so. I am more than willing at any given point in time to abandon the presentation completely if that's where this group would like to go. Because this is, for the next 5 minutes, your session, your time. And it's important that you get what you want out of it. Here's what I've got as an overview, and we'll have about 2 minutes per section. I don't know. It's about 10 minutes per section. What is a blog? How are blogs used in learning? A little bit about blogging systems. I'll show you some stuff. The concepts of blog, aggregation, and RSS. I forgot to put a section in there. A little bit about the theory behind blogs, and then some quick examples of blogs in learning. I'm going to be moving pretty quickly because time is limited. This is, as they say, the 35,000-foot view. And because we don't have, like, 3 weeks to cover all of this stuff. If I'm covering stuff that you know, again, tell me. And we'll move to something that hopefully you don't know. And if it gets really interesting, we'll move to stuff that I don't know. What is a blog? A blog is a website, beginning and end of the story. And it's a website that has a particular format. A blog consists of a series of entries called posts. And these posts are organized by date, such that the most recent post appears at the top of the website. And then the next most recent, and so on down the line. So that if you go to read a blog, you go to the website, you start at the top, and you read down until you get to something you've already seen, and then you're caught up. And that's probably the beginning and the end of a definition of blogs. Out there in the world, you'll see things like a blog is a personal journal, or a blog is a teenage girl expressing angst at her teachers. But there are more than 4 million blogs out there. I think I heard a number the other day, 6 million, but I think that's a bit inflated. But it's definitely 4 million active blogs. Blogs cover all range of content. They're everything from teenage girls or younger. I met and talked to a bunch of grade 5 students who were blogging in Quebec, all the way through to people who are very old. Demographically, the vast majority of bloggers is under 25. That's almost twice that. I'm in a very small minority of bloggers. I think I'm in the top, the 2% oldest bloggers. So for the most part, it's a young person's phenomenon. Many examples of blogs. I can never find my cursor on this thing. Here we go. Let's just take a quick look at a couple so you get the feel for it. This isn't it. This is just a reference page. I thought I would have a mouse rather than one of those finger pads. And of course, we're on the Internet Explorer, so it's a little slow. Oh, we're on campus. Oh, okay. So here's a typical blog. Pretty standard format. You can see the contents of the site are divided into posts. Typically, but not always, a post will have a title. This is the most recent. This was published earlier, a couple days ago. This was published a little bit earlier, and so on down the line. And this one is by someone called Derek Slater, and is an anti-copyright blog. And the use of blogs in learning is relatively recent. Some of the earliest pilot projects were started 2 or 3 years ago. It was only this year that blogs began to be used in learning in any large number. A lot of the exploratory work done by people for example, Will Richardson was done in large number last year. And this is a set of observations. It's not unique to me, and the reference is there. Crooked Timber, by the way, is another blog that you might find interesting. A lot of people like Crooked Timber. Some possible uses for blogging. And this list here sort of moves from the most basic, simple application of blogs, of a blog in a learning environment, to the more complicated, the more involved, the more intensive uses. As a replacement for a typical course page, instructors find it's a lot easier to use a blog than to use a standard web page or something like that, because blogs, as we shall see, are very user-friendly. Once you have a blog, and it's very easy to get a blog, then it becomes simplicity itself to publish on the web. And in fact, a lot of people talk about blogging as being a form of personal publishing. And that's one of the major appeals of blogs, is you don't need to think about formatting or any of that sort of stuff. You type what you need to type, and voila, it's on the web in a nice, beautifully formatted, the nice dated format that you saw up there. All of that's handled automatically by the blogging software. So teachers like to use it to post class notices, deadlines, tests. Well, they won't put the test on the blog, but test deadline, things like that. And as people started doing that, they began adding more information. We moved to the second use, where people start linking to items of interest related to the course. In one of the articles that I wrote, Educational Blogging, which I'll refer to recently, I linked to an example of an archaeology professor who's always putting new and interesting resources about archaeology onto his blog. So it becomes more than just course information. It becomes almost like the professor's research instantiated in blog form. And the usefulness of this is not simply to provide a series of resources for students, although it certainly does that. The usefulness is that because blogs are very much the expression of the individual, the person who's writing a blog, when an instructor blogs about his or her research interests, the interest in the subject, the passion about the subject, comes through. And so it serves as not only an information source, but a motivating source. It tells the students that the instructor is interested and engaged in the topic that he or she is teaching. Moving through the uses of blogs, blogs begin to be used to bring the students into that process. And so we get the third item here, organization of in-class discussions. Typically, a blog, in addition to consisting of the posts that I described, will have the capacity for a person to make a comment at the end of each post. So you put a post up, the students can read the post, then they can add their comments. And a little bit of a community begins to form out of that, particularly with a blog dedicated to a particular subject or to a particular audience, as people begin to respond to the posts and to respond to each other's comments in the series of posts. And it's a small step from there, from getting the students to comment on blog posts, to get the students to begin to contribute content themselves. As a blog or a blogging system or a related system is made available to students in order to do things like organize seminars and readings and other things like that. So instead of just the professor contributing resources, now the members of the class contribute resources as well. And it becomes a bit more of a dynamic process, particularly when students start commenting on each other's resources. And the nice thing is it allows the professor to disengage a little bit. The professor isn't the one producing all the content and initiating all the discussion in the course. It becomes more of a group effort, more of a community effort. And then the final stage is where students are fully integrated into blogging, where they're using blogs as part of their coursework, where they're maintaining their own individual blogs doing their own research, coming up with their own ideas. A good example of that in this past year, I don't have the link here, I'm sorry, because I didn't think of it, is David Wiley's course that he has going on at the University of Utah. What's it called? I forget what it's called. But if you look up David Wiley in course on Google, it'll probably be among the top links. And he has all of his students blogging. W-I-L-E-Y, Wiley. I felt like spelling me for a second there. Could you use that in a sentence, please? yes, please spell David Wiley. yeah, David Wiley is well known in the field of instructional technology and new media. And I actually recommend, if you find his course, going through his course as a whole. It'll cover many of these topics. And if you follow his students' blogs as they've gone through these topics, you'll find just hours and hours and hours of fascinating reading. You kill your whole Christmas break. I wonder if I can't find that. I don't want to linger too long on this, but oh, gee. See, in Firefox, I'm used to having Google right there. One thing I've found about Google over the years, it's replacing my brain. And I wouldn't mind so much, but Google's actually better. Okay, well, we'll wait for that to open. I'll come back to it. And that's his homepage, and the link to the course will probably be right off his homepage. Two major types of blogging system: hosted, which means that some company out there has set up a service, and you log on to their service, use their website, and put your blog on their site. And then server type, where you get a piece of software, you install it on your own web server, or in this environment, you convince somebody from computer services to do it for you, and then your blog runs on your own system. Probably the most famous of the hosted systems is Blogger, and I'm going to zip into Blogger for a sec, because this will show you how simple it is. Actually, let's create a blog. Forget this. I'm on a new system here, so let's... Unless it's going to make... I don't think it sends me any authentication. Let's choose a username. We'll call it Vincent. Sure, why not? Password. Oops. I'm making it up, but I still spelled it wrong. And if you're wondering what the password is, Mount Saint, all lowercase. And I'll retype that. Display name, in case you forget the password, and I'll put my own email address in here, and you guys can change that later if you want, and we pretend to accept the terms of service. Oh, it's not available, isn't that? Yeah, that one's probably free. Where's the delete key here? Yeah, it's hidden. See what happens when I use someone else's computer? And that's you. That should be available. And the password is now Vincent. Thing is, you guys can go into this and mess around with this after the talk. So you just go to the Blogger homepage and log in with these. And, oh, okay. As for you, and let's give it an address. Now you have to use it. And we'll continue. La-di-da-di-da-da. So it's pretty basic, right? Create a name, create a title, create an address. And sorry, somebody's taken that address. Isn't that interesting? We'll go have a look at that in a moment.
Remember the password?
Hey, here's David Wiley's site, wiley.ed.usu.edu. And I don't see the course here, but if you tootle around the side a little bit, you'll see it. And okay, I'm just let that load. Whoops. Oh, I've lost. Right. And I didn't even want to do it on this. Where did my other? Oh, there it is. Okay. Let's get rid of that. Whee. Yeah, the address is blogger. It's always blogspot. So, msvu.blogspot.com. And let's see what we get. I'm always making that mistake. MSVU connection. It's probably your student. No? Okay. Okay, so here we have an example of a blog created by somebody in the room.
We don't want to talk.
Okay. That's the other thing, if you're using blogs, either you or your students, they are, especially on a site like Blogger, they're public. And you never know when they're going to be used in a presentation or something. So, MSVU 2. All right. So, the one we're creating will be at msvu2.blogspot.com. Now we just pick a template. Sure.
Oh,
okay.
Okay.
Okay, well. Oh, okay. I'm gonna pick a nice conservative template here. Whoops, that's not what I wanted. The blogs like this blog here. Okay, I've checked the little box there. These are personal. Typically, you would keep your username and your password to yourself, and she's kept hers to herself. I can't go in and change her blog.
Okay, you can't
add.
It's
not
like anyone can
live in actual discussion. No, well, it depends.
The
yeah, the main part of it, now there's the blog comments, and that's actually been a large issue in blogging. Because blogs typically allow comments, and what's happened over the last 6 months or so is comment spam,
yeah.
Naturally. So movable type has really been hit hard, and they've actually come up with what they call the movable type blacklist system, and that's a plug-in, a little piece of software that you add to your movable type installation. And what it does is it filters the comments as they come in. And it mostly works. It doesn't completely work, but it mostly works. On my site, I use a modified form of the movable type system. And then I also have another system to make sure that the comment is actually coming from somebody who's reading the site rather than a computer program. It's the computer programs that are the big problem. But in LiveJournal, which is another one of these hosted sites that I mentioned on the slide that we're still on, that's been a real problem. The users of LiveJournal are typically younger. It's the youngest demographic of all of the blogspheres on LiveJournal. Large number of teens. And teens can be vicious in their comments. And in LiveJournal, there have been an increasing number of users who have been locking their comments down to prevent people from commenting, because people will come in, comments, and they'll be really rude and obnoxious. What LiveJournal does, it has a social networking aspect to it as well, where you can pick other LiveJournal members as your friends. And so you can lock your comments so that only your friends can comment. And that's more and more LiveJournal users are using that feature. I browse through these blogging systems, just random blogs from time to time, sit down for an evening, hit 100 blogs or so. And so you sort of get a sense of the movement. And the movement is away from open comments and toward locking them down somehow. It's a slow movement, but It's glacial. It's unstoppable. It's definitely moving. Movable type is software that you purchase and install on your computer system, and then once it's up and running, it's as though you have something like Blogger running on your own site. So we've created a blog here with Blogger. And by the way, we're done. I picked the template because nobody suggested anything. And we're done. That was the work involved in creating a Blogger blog. So now we can start posting. And it's going to be a little slow here. Oops, and now it's going to freeze. All right, let me get rid of this window because I don't need it anymore. All right, this is a typical blog window for posting. And the essence of a blog is two fields. The title and whatever you want to say. And the title's optional. So let's title this. Okay, and let's just toss in a link to the other one. I could just type it in as hypertext, because I know how to do hypertext fairly easily, but if I don't, I just use the little pop-up form here, and what was it called again? msbu.blogspot.com. And there's my link. And that's all I have to say. And Blogger has added lots of neat things like font selection. So let's pick Georgia. Let's pick huge. And we'll publish the post. So that's all there is involved in creating a blog entry. Doesn't take very long. And now once I've published the post, it's still out there in the world. Now I publish it as a blog. That way I can work on my blog for a while, right? Work on a post, come back to it. And now let's take a look at my brand new blog. And there it is. And that's online. That's available to the world. It's beautifully formatted. The link works. See? And if I post another post, it'll add the post at the top, move this one down, keep everything dated, we're away to the races. Blogging is that easy. The amount of time it takes to train a professor to create a blog, I don't know, 5 minutes, maybe. Depends on what program they're in. Yep. That's how they respond. So, oops, post a comment. So, blog does not allow anonymous comments. So, and again, this is the comment spam. What Google has started, Google owns Blogger, by the way. It originally founded by a company called Pyra. And a few months ago, I guess about 6 months ago now, Google bought Blogger, which sent ripples through the blogging community. Now, one of the things that Google did is they required that people be logged on with a Blogger ID in order to post a comment. And that was their response to the spamming problem. So comment has been appeared. It's also going to run through some spam detection and stuff, so we won't see it right away. So blogging, and there's the address for LiveJournal, which I mentioned. If you're just exploring blogs for the first time, go to these sites and just look around randomly at them to get a feel. LiveJournal especially has a random, you know, go to any random LiveJournal feed. With Blogger, you have to find a blog, and then there's a little button in the upper that says go to the next blog. The next blog is random. And so you can sit there and just look at random blogs. It's an eye-opening experience. All those people who say our youth today are illiterate, they're not. It's just they're not doing their work at school. They're doing their work online in their blogs. There's some amazing content out there. Movable type is... Oh, I'm sorry. Absolutely, yes. Organizations are using blogging as a means of internal communication. I can't really show them to you because they're usually behind firewalls and that. The best known example is, ironically, at Microsoft. I say ironically because Microsoft is a very late entrance into blogging. They just came out a couple of weeks ago with something they call MSN Spaces, which is their own answer to Blogger. But Microsoft has a person called Robert Scoble, has a blog called Scobalizer, and he is Microsoft's main public blogger. And Microsoft also has an initiative called Channel 9. And what Channel 9 is a space for Microsoft software developers to comment among themselves about the projects that they're working on, and the idea is that the public at large can listen in to this conversation and get a sense of what happens behind the scenes. So if you go have a look at those, Scoble is spelled S-C-O-B-L-E, as Robert Scoble. Movable type is commercial, it costs you money. It's very popular, very stable, good user community, people like Seb Piquette, who I work with at the National Research Council, has installed movable type on an institution-wide basis. WordPress is a non-commercial, open-source version of blogging software. It's less well-developed. The real work on it has only been started in the last 6 months or so. It'll probably catch movable type in a year and a half. But there's a lot of work happening in WordPress. I have a WordPress installed on my website, but it never works. So it's early days for WordPress yet. Honestly, if you're just beginning blogging, go to Blogger. It's easy, it's free, and it gives you a feel without really having to make any investment. And if it's not for you, just abandon your blog. Nothing bad will happen. Oh yeah, you just leave it sitting there. I'm not sure if you can delete a blog or not. It's never actually occurred to me. But I don't think that's Google's problem, not mine. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
It's kind of a tough call, right? Because the content that people put on blogs belongs to them, not to Google. So Google can't just come in willy-nilly and start erasing blogs. Sometimes people put up blogs to demonstrate something or to show something or to record something. My NAWEB blog I did a few years ago at a conference in Fredericton, I did specifically for the conference in order to show people blogging and to provide a space for people at that conference to blog. I imagine it's still up there. I hope it is, because, you know, it's now part of a historical archive. You know, I'd be unhappy if Google just came and deleted it. But I haven't touched it for a year and a half, 2 years. Well, it's Google, right? Yeah, it's advertising. Also, too, Google uses blog and blog content as important raw material for the ordering of its search results. So it's kind of like Google, in buying Blogger, bought a huge world brain. So, and that's the main thing for Google, is that. But also, Google has a program called AdSense. And what Google does is allows people to put ads on their blogs, and then it shares the revenue with them. I have an AdSense on one of my, it's not affiliated with my work. It's a personal blog, and My Google ads have earned me a total of 86 cents. Oh, I've had the blog since 98, but I've had AdSense for about a month, actually about 20 days. So I figure in 100 months or so, I'll be able to collect my first check. Yeah, what can you do? Sure, go ahead. That's quite right. As was mentioned, you can tell Blogger where your website is and how to FTP or transfer the files from Google to your website. That also lets you set your own domain name so that you don't have to use the Blogspot domain name. I just wanted to point out, I don't have a whole lot of time left, which is really unfortunate because there's so much to cover. There's blogging proper, but there's an expanding space in the area of personal publishing, and it's expanding in two directions. One direction is towards more organized, more formal systems, content management systems. And I pick out four examples here: Post News, Scoop, Drupal, Plug. These four I pick out because they're open source, free software. These are all software written either in Perl or PHP. These are two computer programming languages. And you can install them on your web server. And what they do is they create an online community. They will allow you, almost as simply as Blogger, they will allow members to post news articles. And they'll present these news articles. But the content management system will support a number of additional features. It will support individual user registration. They're very customizable. You can create blocks that you put on your page. They support things like polls. They usually come with a discussion board, a discussion list. They're organized into topics. I don't have time to really go exploring into them a whole lot, but if you're looking at ways of making personal publishing available to people, don't just jump into a blogging solution per se. Any of these systems will give you the same functionality and additional functionality. Now, you're buying that at the cost of more maintenance, obviously, but not a lot more maintenance. Once these systems are installed, they pretty much run themselves, and they're mostly easy to install. Scoop's a bit of a trick. But the others, I've installed all of these. PostNuke, Drupal, and Plone, half an hour. And then you play with it for a while and sort of get a feel for it and customize it to your own taste, which could take, well, a lifetime. But, I mean, half an hour to install. Scoop, I actually needed to get some computer service support because it requires some back-end stuff to support the user login system. For those who are technically minded, it requires Mod Perl, a Mod Perl installation first in order to work. On the other side, we have a phenomenon called the wiki. And the wiki is almost the opposite of personal publishing. The wiki is a type of software that creates web pages that anybody can edit. And you might think, how weird. How could that possibly work? But the flagship wiki out there in the world is a site called Wikipedia. Now, Wikipedia is an online encyclopedia. Now, it's been tested for the accuracy of its content, and it compares favorably with Encyclopedia Britannica, except, of course, it's more up-to-date. A couple of months ago, it reached its 1 millionth article. It has more readers than Encyclopedia Britannica. So Wikipedia is basically in the process of replacing Encyclopedia Britannica. And wiki is the Hawaiian word for quick. And how quick? Well, let me show you how quick. Instead of messing up Wikipedia, I'll just go to my own site. I have a wiki installed on my site. It's a type of wiki called Erfurt Wiki. And because it's open source software, I can go in and customize it and format it for myself. So here it is. I see Internet Explorer isn't respecting the table definitions. Anyhow, this is the front page of my wiki. It looks just like part of the website, but that's because I went in and changed the headers and the footers. And the thing is, anyone in the world can edit this page. And how easy is it? Click on edit. Prove that you're not a spam bot. Type your stuff. Now, Wiki has some features, you probably can't see it in the back of the room, that's called Wiki Markup. There's a very intuitive way to do things like create titles, create links, create new pages. I've got a page there, it's just inside, or some text there, just inside some square brackets. If I put some text in square brackets, in fact I'll do it here, what that will do is automatically create a new page on my wiki. You should also notice I'm logged in or anything like this here, and I'm using somebody else's computer, which is why the formatting seems a little off. Anyhow, I'll save my change. And it takes a second. It's got to run through all that blacklist anti-spam stuff. And voila! Here's my page. And you can see what I've just edited. And if I click on this little question mark here, now I'm into my brand new page that I've just created. MSVU blog. And what was the address of that again? MSVU2.blogspot.com. Put another square bracket up. Pretty hard to remember, right? Square brackets for links. Now we'll take a look at the page. And there's my new page, and there's the link to the blog that I just created in Blogger. That easy. Wikipedia is a wiki. It's a wiki encyclopedia. Anybody in the world can add or update or edit an entry in Wikipedia. And oddly, it works. And it works because in a completely open publishing environment, the contributors outweigh the defacers, basically. Now, one of the ways wikis make this possible is for any wiki page, we'll go back to the home page, there's a history of the page that's kept online. All the changes that have happened. See? And here's the current page, and before it, revision 150, is the page that I had before I just made the change. And so if I disagree with what was added to the wiki, I just click this fetchback link and prove that I'm not a spam bot, because spam bots have learned to fetch back their own spam. Very annoying. And now, if I want the previous version to take effect, I just save and voila! The change that I've just made is rolled back. Every wiki page has a history like that. So it's very easy to revert to the previous version of the wiki page. Very quick, hence the name. Very open. And the thing with wikis, though, and this is an important point, is that wikis only work with communities of a certain size, really. Now, I say that I have my own personal wiki that I'm pretty much the only person who contributes to. But in order to make that work, I had to add a bunch of software at the front end to combat things like spam and other stuff. But typically, a wiki is going to be a group process. You need a group of people in order to maintain it, to keep it up to date, to roll back, remarks that are inappropriate and so on. So it does depend on community to work. I like wikis, though. I use my wiki mostly as a scratch pad, and I just toss things on there. When I do a talk, I very frequently create a wiki page for the talk. I didn't do it for this one. I don't know why, but
Sometimes I forget. If I'm working on a paper, I'll create some wiki pages and put some of the sections of the paper in. Things like that. If you take a look through my wiki there, you'll see basically a big scratch pad. Now the thing about blogs, I'm not going to be able to talk about this part a whole lot, but what makes blogs something special again happens when blogs are aggregated. Every blogger system out there, Blogger, LiveJournal, MovableType, every content management system out there, and many wiki systems out there, produce a type of index file that's called RSS, and it's on the next slide. And RSS is a type of file that can be read by a computer. And basically, it's a machine-readable summary of your site. Now, because of these files, or as they're sometimes called, feeds, what that means is the content of your blog can be automatically slurped up by a computer program and brought together with the contents of millions of other blogs. And all of these sites here, Blogdex, Popdex, Daypop, Blogdigger, TechnoReady, they all harvest millions of blogs. So, take a look at a site like, let's see if they're up. They were down this morning. There we go. Here's Blogdex. Blogdex is a constantly changing index of the most popular links in the blogosphere right now. So what are people around the world linking to in their blogs? Well, the main thing that they're linking to is this item right here. Build an online photo album. Haven't followed it yet in this news. Don't know what to find it. Search the web with Hotbot. Boy, oh boy. I'm not going to flip into these sites. Because the interests of the web as a whole are not always G-rated. BBC News. So I'm not going to link into that one looking at the headline, Japanese men lap up new comfort. BBC. It's that dry English humor. So these are some, there are about 150 separate aggregators. These are probably the major five right now. These are a major tool for me because they allow me to keep up with what's happening out there in the world of blogs. What does RSS look like? Well, here's a sample. Now, this is Internet Explorer trying to interpret it, and more or less succeeding. If we take a look at what it actually looks like, this will be a bit hard to see, won't it? What it is an XML file. And I know at the back of the room it's all just squiggles, but up here is a little bit of XML that tells people about the site, the link, when it was last built, who wrote it, what the copyright is, who the publisher is, the title. And then a bunch of items, and each item corresponds to a blog post. And the items have a link, a title, or a description, and that's it. It's a very simple format. If you look at this link, you look at this file for a little bit, you'll figure it out. It'll take you less than half an hour to figure it out. And if you can't figure it out, I have a paper on my website, how to create an RSS feed with Notepad, a web server, and a beer. And it'll give you the actual guts as to how to create an RSS feed hand. But the beauty of RSS is it is automatically created by all of these publishing tools. It stands for... is that what you're looking for, what it stands for? Or? Yeah, I have it on the slide here. Yeah. It was originally created by Netscape in the mid-90s under the name of Rich Site Summary. Some people call it RDF site summary. That would apply to version 1.0. Some people call it really simple syndication. Some people don't call it RSS at all. They call it ATOM. And they do it a little bit differently. This is the thing about RSS is, RSS isn't like learning object metadata or any of these things where there's a standards body and a standards process and it gets passed before IEEE or ISO or whatever. RSS has no organizing body. None. There is no committee that decides what RSS is. RSS is whatever the community as a whole does. And what the community as a whole has evolved into three or four separate streams. And anybody can add an extension, or as they call them, a mod, to RSS. One of the bits of work that I've done over the last couple of years is to create an RSS module called RSS LUM, which is Learning Object Metadata for RSS Feeds. And what I'm up to with that project is to use a system like blog publishing software, or probably something like one of those content management systems that we saw, to use that as an interface for people to create learning content. And then the learning content is syndicated using an RSS feed just the way a blog content is. So that people who are out there looking for learning material can use a service like Technorati, Daypop, and aggregate this learning content. And so my extension is to add some learning object metadata to the RSS feed so that we can have a specialized learning content aggregator that makes use of this. And I actually have an implementation. I know I don't have a whole lot of time, so that's why I'm skipping around a wee bit. That's right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. And the idea here is that this is all done automatically by the system so that course content creators or instructors don't need to worry about things like metadata formats, content aggregation. All they need to do is go to a site like this called DLearn and search for the learning materials that they're interested in. I still have to spell them correctly. And here are learning materials, Russia. I just picked that off the top of my head. I like to pick something different every time because you never know what you're going
to
get. I'm talking about the formatting or the creation of an RSS file. Remember that RSS file that I showed you that was kind of a lot of squiggles?
Nobody needs to worry about
typing that in. It's all generated automatically. I need to worry about typing that in because I write software that creates those kind of files. But the typical instructor should never have to worry. We have 4 million people who create blogs, and about, I don't know, maybe a couple of thousand of them have created an RSS feed. But Blogger does the rest, all automatically. So, in the world of learning, there are organizations that are beginning to create RSS feeds for learning content. And here are some of them, which is Australia, Maricopa, which is Arizona, Cario, which is based in Calgary, Hamble, which is British, Rice University, U.S. Journal of Academics. These are academic organizations creating learning content using systems that are similar to blogging software, and then I'm able to aggregate them with DLearn. This is very preliminary, still very much pilot, because this is a very small percentage of the learning materials out there that are created. But once this gets into a larger scale, it'll be like having a global educational reference library at your fingertip. That's the way it should work. That's the way it's already working in the world of RSS and blogs. this couple, it's such a changing field. People can blog photos now with a site called Flickr. Notice there's no E in Flickr in that URL. And music, the thing, it was invented in August. Podcasting makes use of a particular RSS extension in order to create musical feeds. And what you do is you hook up your iPod to your computer and you go to sleep. And you wake up in the morning, take your iPod off your computer, go off, do your thing, and the day's programming is radio programming has been loaded onto your iPod. Where did the programming come from? Blogs all over the world. You pick the blogs, you pick the sources. So cool. Mobile blogging or mobile blogging. There are audio blogs out there, like things for podcasting. You want to do a blog post, you're not near a computer, phone it in. Send a text message in if you want it in text. There are all kinds of ways of getting content into blogging systems today. Collaborative blogging, Furl. Basically, you go, you register a URL at Furl, and then Furl mixes it and mashes it, comes up with a group blog. Social networking, I won't even talk about. There's a whole other range of similar interaction and communications technologies. Here are some examples. Just across the street there, University of Prince Edward Island this year started up a pretty large web blogging initiative. Whoops, that's not where I wanted to go. And if you're looking to see what can be done on an institutional level in our sort of academic institutional culture, this is the place to do it. They've done a lot of things right. And what I really like about the UPEI initiative is the organization of this is done by a combined student academic committee. It's not a top-down initiative. And the nuts and bolts are handled by the student newspaper. Brilliant. Just brilliant. So I do recommend that you take a look at weblogs at UPEI. Weblogs at Harvard Law is an older initiative. Anyone with a Harvard email address can have a weblog. And there are lots of weblogs there. Some of them are really good. Some of them are really trivial. That's the nature of blogging.
Would somebody serve as an alumni gathering spot?
That's exactly what happens. A lot of the weblogs at Harvard are alumni. So, and it's the nice thing, you know, you go online with a course, you have an online course, you have an online community, starts in September, you get to know everybody, you get to know the technology, you have a community, and wham, you're cut off, you're ended. But with a community of bloggers and associated resources, and if you attach a personal portfolio to this, or e-portfolio, it's a whole separate talk, but if you look up on Google e-portfolio, you'll see a lot of resources. Now you have an online presence and an online community that begins possibly even before your university career, because it becomes a recruitment tool. You know, you begin to make your connections and do your reading before you're into university. It becomes a major focus for your work through university, and then it continues on after university and becomes your professional portfolio. And that's the way it should work. Because websites, web content, does not belong to institutions. It's not something that should be started and stopped at the whim of a computer services department or at the whim of an academic decision, because it belongs to the person creating the content. And when it does belong to that person, then they are much more likely to put in the sort of effort required to create a lifetime portfolio and to create a presence online. And I think that in the future that we're going to see is much serious original writing and photography and audio recording done in these personal spaces as anywhere else. I think there's a lot of potential. It's already showing its potential. Almost there. Started late, so I'm taking a bit of time. Yeah. Educational Bloggers Network is a collection of, last time I looked at it, about 80 separate educational bloggers. It's a small percentage, but they formed a community.
So when you talk about this as a personal space, how is that different?
It's different from having your own website in that it's a lot more flexible than a website ever was because of the range of contents that you can put into it, and it's a lot easier to maintain because the software now does a lot of the organization, categorization, and things like that all automatically for you so that you are able to focus on the content rather than setting up the website. That's the big advantage. And it acts as a distribution system, too. You need to worry about publicizing it and all of that. It'll put out RSS feeds for you, and so your content automatically goes out into the world. Don't have a lot to talk about, a lot of time to talk about this here. There's quite a bit of theory, including network theory, as well as learning theory behind the use of weblogs and wikis and social networks in learning. The social networks, the work of Duncan J. Watts in his book 6 Degrees. The origins of this is all in mathematical graph theory. And if you really want to get into the guts of that, look up a mathematician called Erdos. Watts has become very famous, and justifiably so, for his work in the mathematics and organization of social networks. It also has to do with neural networks and the organization, or more accurately, the self-organization of multiple layers of connected nodes, or as they're sometimes called, units. And that's the area that I'm focusing in. I talk from time to time in my papers about the self-organizing web. And when people ask me about things like the future of search, I say the future of search is the end of search, and the web itself will organize itself so that you don't have to search. You set up your website, and the web, the resources you want are simply there. You don't have to go find them. And that's, to a large degree, the sort of thing that I've been trying to set up with some of the services on my own webpage. George Siemens came out 2 or 3 days ago with a wonderful paper called Connectivism, which I think is a perfectly good name for this combined approach of technology and theory. Some of the major principles, promoting a diversity of opinions. Learning is about collecting specialized nodes or information sources. Learning is available in non-human appliances. I talk about fishing rods that teach you how to fish. And the same technology can be used to do that, because if you think about it, a fishing rod is an output device in the same way that Technorati or Blogdex, which I showed you, is an output device. It's just an output device that specializes in fishing. And at any given time, educational resources will be available to your fishing rod and will allow your fishing rod to teach you how to fish. The capacity to know is more critical than what you know. Continued learning through nurturing and maintaining connections, and the ability to see connections, what William Gibson calls idoru, is becoming a core skill. Being able to, if you will, ride the network. Douglas Rushkoff talks about it as riding the wave or surfing the wave. And the idea is that in multiple simultaneous instances of a phenomena, it is a core skill to be able to detect patterns in that phenomena. But it's not something that's magical or strange. We already have this capacity innately. And that capacity is instantiated by our capacity to recognize a face on a television screen. It's the same sort of thing. A television screen is nothing more than a simultaneous activation of a bunch of points or pixels. And yet we can look at that and recognize Richard Nixon. And that same capacity can be used to recognize non-physical entities, can be used to recognize trends or events or relationships. So there's a lot of theory behind the idea of using blogs, social networks, and the like in learning. I've written a lot about it. This is the last slide. On my website, some of the more recent things, learning networks, which is a proposal of an analogy for learning resources, and an extended criticism of learning management systems and federated searching and a lot of the technologies that are coming out of larger institutions. Educational blogging is very similar to the content of this talk. The semantic social network talks about content networks combined with social networks. And then more than personal, that's about a year or so old, and that talks about weblogs in very generic terms, and I included it here because at the base of that is another 10 or 15 or so resources. So I hope you enjoyed this talk. This is probably all I have time for today. I really appreciate you taking some time in late December to come out here for this talk, and thank you very much. See, really was the last flight.
Before you leave, I'm sorry I didn't meet you at the beginning.
But we missed that. That's Danelle.
I'm interested in all of this from a research perspective. And I'm wondering, and itching to get back to my office so I can go into some of these sites and some specific content. But my concern is, as a researcher, could you talk about the ethics of research, researching blogs?
Talk about
investigating the discourse that's going on.
Talk about the ethics of researching blogs. That's a hard one. I mean, blogs are, by their very nature, public documents. So on one hand, there's really no more ethics involved in researching blogs than there is ethics involved in researching academic articles and journals. On the other hand, there's a lot of work with blogs recently has started to involve students and groups of students and class projects and things like that. And there you very much get into ethics, and in particular, personal privacy. Because one of the issues that has come up quite a bit is when a student is required to produce a piece of work for a class in something like Blogger, is whether this work ought to be public. And it seems to me that it ought to be up to the individual in question as to whether or not their work becomes public. But the choice has to be left to the individual student rather than the institution. If the work is private, and if you are using this work in the course of academic research on blogging and learning, then you're in ethics committee territory, because now you're doing human research on humans. And so there needs to be the typical clearances for that. The subject needs to be aware, they have to give permission, and that sort of thing. And it has to be the case that people being researched have the right to not be included in that research group. Now, is that sort of what you were after with that?
Yeah, I kind of after the fact, though, for example, if I want to go and look at, and essentially, isn't that what you're doing with BRRS? Or these indexing. I mean, you're gathering up people's thoughts, and in this case of your project, actually,
right.
You might be selling it, or it might be there for purchase, which adds a whole other dimension.
It sure does.
That's in the past, then. So, if I wanted to go into some of these topics and look at, for example, my area is reader response. So, what are people talking about? What are people saying about certain books that they're reading?
Sure.
And I use that after the fact. Is it pretty common knowledge that a blog is public?
Yes. Yes, it is very common, although people are continually taken by surprise. But yes, it is common knowledge that blogs are public and that are public accessible. Now, of course, there's this whole area of taking the content and using it elsewhere. Blogs are covered under copyright, just like any other word. But putting something on Blogger, say, is like putting something on a bulletin board downtown. And you can't come along later and say, well, people didn't have the right to look at it, because it was on a bulletin board. You could see it just in passing. And because you can see it just in passing, you do thereby acquire certain rights under, in this country, the doctrine of fair dealing. You have the right to quote it. You have the right to point to it. You have the right to comment on it and to criticize it. You have the right to use a certain percentage, I think something like less than 10% or 20%, I forget the exact amount, snippets of the total work. It is owned by the person, though, and so you can't simply incorporate it into your own material. If it is expected that content of a blog should be private, then the onus is on the person owning the blog to actually put up some sort of barrier to access. It would be like a lock and a key. In the blogging world, the online world, it's like a login or something like that. And it's not, the technology to do that is free and widely available. HT access will lock any web directory behind a password protection. So it's not hard to protect this stuff. Does that help?
Yes.
Anything else? Way hit okay. The back. What kind of problems have you come across using a blog for a course or things like that? The biggest problem is inappropriate content, where a person uses language that we may say is colorful, because there is no built-in censoring mechanism on any of this stuff except the Microsoft stuff, which figures. There have been a number of instances where students have been disciplined for comments that they've made about other students, about their instructors. In the United States, people have gotten knocks on the doors in the middle of the night, and this is documented because of political content, so that's become an issue. Copyright continues to be a major issue. It's very easy to link to or to add an image to your blog, and it's very easy to find such content all over the World Wide Web. And not all of it is freely available. Sometimes people do not want to share their content. We generally call those people content hoarders, but they have the right, and therefore watching student blogs for content that has been borrowed from other sites is something that is encouraged. Although it's not clear at this point whether it's an academic institution's responsibility to act as a police force, and this is an area of law that continues to be up in the air. Although typically, in order to stay on the right side of the law, and more importantly, on the right side of the lawsuits, an academic institution will have policies in place regarding the use of copyrighted material, and when they're made aware of that, will take action in order to make sure that that material is removed. What other issues? Plagiarism, which is a variant on the theme. Although that tends to be less so the case in the blogging community because of the aggregators. If you copy someone else's work, it's going to show up in the same place as the other person's work on any of these searches or aggregations. So if you're plagiarizing in the blogosphere, it becomes immediately obvious, and the whole world can see it. Consequently, there's almost no plagiarism in the blogging community. What else? I mean, the major issues are variations on that theme. Weblogs at Harvard ran into an issue where one of their students got their hands on some memos describing the mechanisms used by the Diebold electronic voting machines. And the memos were, to say the least, more than a little incriminating. And what this person did is posted the memos on his blog. Diebold sued Harvard. And Diebold ultimately lost the case. And nonetheless, even if you're Harvard, you don't really like to get sued by a large company that's running your national elections.
Or other things.
Yeah, like automatic tellers, which is their major project product.
Foreign land,
yeah. A
couple more questions, Karen.
I was just wondering what trends you might be aware of
that are
happening in education
institutions
and blogs.
Well, the use of blogs itself is the major trend for this year. Prior to September of 2004, there were just a few There were just a few pilot projects out there. In September, there was a fairly wide-scale adoption by institutions across Canada, the United States, Europe, Australia. And so I think the big trend now will be the wave of research reports that follows that. And I'll tell you right now, they're not all going to be uniformly positive. And the reason for that is blogging isn't for everyone. Just like writing a journal isn't for everyone, just like writing in general isn't for everyone. But it has been a little bit of hype about blogging, although for the most part not from bloggers themselves, but from some of the coverage in places like CNET or the Wall Street Journal or whatever. There's been hype about blogging, but people who are in blogging realize that most people don't blog. And even that community that's involved in blogs, most of them don't blog. And the same is going to be true in an academic environment. Will Richardson, who runs a site called Weblogged, Weglogg-ED. You look that up on Google. There's also a link to it in there. He's in his third year of blogging in classes. That makes him one of the pioneers. And he's been expressing recently, I don't want to say skepticism, but more along the lines of cautionary notes. A lot of students, they'll start blogging for their class. The class is over, they'll drop it like hot potatoes. Some of those don't like the idea of their college or their university or their school making them blog, because blogs have always been something that's theirs, not the institutions, and now the institutions kind of taking it over on them, and they react to that and they resist. So, and also to a lot of the blogging projects that were started up this year were kind of like aimless blogging projects. It was sort of along the lines of, okay, set up a blog and use it as your personal journal. It turns out that when students are given these complete lack of context for writing, that they drift. And so we'll see some of the research studies, we're already seeing, you know, the leading edge of them, showing that when they're not given anything to write about, they write about nothing. Either they write nothing, or what they write about is really trivial. That's not 100% of the cases, obviously, but it is nonetheless true. So we're going to learn more about how to use blogging in learning, what works, what doesn't work, and we're going to learn that, and it's going to be announced as a big discovery, blogging needs to be targeted. It's one thing among many things that you do. Even in here, I have a slide, right? You know, there's the array of tools. I think we'll see later on people come to realize that, well, if you use blogging, and if you use instant messaging, and if you use podcasting, and if you use wiki, now you've got something that's really interesting happening here. But none of these technologies does it all by itself. Even the whole ensemble doesn't do it all by itself. You know, students still want to meet other students, not necessarily for learning, but they still want to meet other students, and they still want to do it in a common place. So there's going to be a place for this, and a lot of the research that we're going to see is going to be directed toward delineating that place and finding out where these technologies are most effective, what sort of educational principles that you use the best, what sort of social presence they create, and how that social presence can or should be used in order to improve learning. So that's what we're going to see. We're going to see much more multimedia. Podcasting is like not even 4 months old. Podcasting is going to be huge. I think over time podcasting will replace radio because it's more reliable, it's better content, it's more varied, you can customize it. If you want the all Shania Twain radio station, it's there. So yeah, and we're going to see much more photo blogging, much more mom blogging. We're going to see a lot of this become almost like background noise. And if you, and yeah, think waves, right? Think, you know, dynamic. Now we have all of this stuff happening as a standing wave in the background. And then, starting next year, year after, we're going to begin to see the melodies. We're going to begin to see a lot of this stuff really brought out and brought together. We still haven't seen yet, and I'm working on this, and I might not be first, and it won't bother me if I'm not, a mixing of social networking and content networking. Social networks and content networks are still separate entities on the web. And I wrote a paper, though I mentioned it, the semantic social network. I wrote the paper, I sat back and waited for somebody to build it. Never happened. I'm sitting there. I don't get it. It's such an obvious move. It's going to happen. And that's going to cause huge ripple effects when it does. We're going to see this stuff have a huge impact in other areas. A person called Dan Gilmore, G-I-L-L-M-O-R, a long-time columnist for the San Jose Mercury News, about 4 or 5 days ago, quit his job. Gilmore is well noted because he wrote a book. He wrote a book, he put it on a wiki and had his readers fix the book, and then he published it, and I'm not sure if it's a bestseller yet, but it's close, called We the Media. And basically the concept is, to have your daily newspaper, you don't need journalists to write your newspaper anymore. What you need is your readers to write your newspaper. And this is where this stuff is headed. And this is a general trend where content won't be produced by content producers. Content will be produced by content consumers. The reader becomes the writer. And this is going to happen, is happening today. In journalism, look at a site called Craigslist. Craigslist is one of the most popular sites on the web. May not have ever heard of it, but that's the way the web works, right? Craigslist is citizen participatory journalism. And we're going to see this in learning. People ask me, you know, where's learning content going to come from? And I keep telling them, and nobody believes me, it's going to come from the students. It's not going to come from McGraw-Hill. It's not going to come from MSVU. It's going to come from the students. And the role, increasingly, that instructors will play, even in especially in a university environment, but even in the lower environment, will be the role of steward, of coach, of mentor, of aggregator, of assimilator, of the person who kind of makes this production of content happen, kind of encourages it, but the students themselves will produce a lot of educational material. And if you think about it, it makes sense. Number one, students are cheap labor. Number two, students speak the language that students speak. Number three, students have no end of imagination. Number four, there's a lot of them. There's a lot more of them than there are of us. If you look at it from a purely content-based economic point of view, it makes sense. The only problem that would really block it is whether or not students have the capacity to produce educational material that would be worth reading. But that's where your role comes in. That's where you play a role. And you have to keep in mind, if even one out of 100 students produces something that's half decent that can be shared, that means we're going to have millions of resources. Because, like I said, there's a lot of students. The success rate can be very low, and it still works. So long as we have the content distribution in place so that we can get access to these resources very easily without having to work. So I think, you know, we're just in the business now of setting up that background rate.
There's another spin-off from that, and that's the critical thinking piece of it, because, you know, if when I, as a student, was going to an academic journal, I would have, an initial tendency to say, oh, it came from an academic journal, therefore it must be reliable, quality, etc. But this whole thing of getting information, looking at blogging as a source of information, really got to develop the critical learning sort of critical thinking skills to be able to step back and say, wait a minute, that's an opinion or whatever.
Critical thinking, media literacy, these are core. If they're not teaching them in kindergarten, grade one and on, now, they should be. And I would be astonished, I would be appalled if this area of learning is being left out. One of SchoolNet's major projects that got as much support from me as I could give it was something called the Media Awareness Network. Brilliant resource, and a very important resource. And I've written to Industry Canada over and over and over telling them that, and you should too. After my website, the very first thing I put online was a thing called Stephen's Guide to the Logical Fallacies, because it's a core skill. People need to have the tools to sort out between what they can believe and what they shouldn't believe. And actually, they needed these tools well before the internet. They never had them. There was no real incentive to give them to them. Because they needed these tools in order to understand and analyze broadcast media. One of the very early influential books on me that I read actually comes from this part of the world, actually comes from Nova Scotia, which means some of you may have read it. A book called Between the Lines was written by Eleanor McLean. It was huge in the student newspaper circuit. Huge. A very important book. I think it's out of print now, which says something. I liked it a lot because it covered most of the logical fallacies well, and it was interesting to see it because it was Nova Scotia-centered. Atlantic Canada Centre, all Nova Scotia and New Brunswick example, a lot of stuff about Irving, a lot of stuff about local politics here. And it was very influential on me. And that kind of content, that kind of information is going to become increasingly important for our student population. And as I said, especially the younger ones, as they're forming a lot of their core beliefs, they need to have the mechanisms to allow them to form core beliefs that will serve them well in life.
I think we'll have to wrap up. Stephen, we may have a few moments for an individual discussion. Again, we'd like to thank Stephen for coming and talking to us.
Thanks a lot for the questions and for staying around almost an hour after the talk. I really appreciate that.
Sorry, I didn't mean to rush you by thanking you prematurely, but from the way you were speaking since I missed the introduction, I thought you had to rush off instantly.
Well, I wanted to make sure that I gave the group the option of finishing on time. I do need to be in Wolfville a little bit later today, but this certainly was time for this, and I'm really glad we did it.
Thank you.